Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now is my good friend, Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, one of the nation's leading space thinkers as well as budgetary minds. Todd, welcome back.
Hey, good to be back, Vago.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Todd, always a pleasure having you on. The U.S. government is objecting to a recent Russian anti-satellite weapons test in orbit. What is it that the Russians have done that has Washington so hot and bothered?
Yeah, so what they did is, this is actually the same satellite, it's called Cosmos 2543, that was in the news earlier this year, where it was apparently trailing a classified U.S. government satellite. And it had entered into a close orbit around that satellite. And at the time, the Russians have identified it as an inspector satellite. So it was already known to be something that was suspicious. And what happened is on July 15th, this Russian satellite ejected another satellite, another object into space nearby. And so a week after that, United States Space Command came out with a public statement that said that they believed this was a non-destructive anti-satellite test. And so I think the key thing, you know, to point out here is this is a space-based anti-satellite weapon as opposed to a ground-based anti-satellite weapon.
Right.
So like what we've seen, you know, a lot of other countries, including China, Russia, and India, even the United States years back, have all tested ground-based anti-satellite weapons. So now we're seeing Russia test a space-based weapon as well. I would note, though, this is not the first time that the Russians, or I should say the Soviets, have tested space-based weapons. But it is, you know, on a different level because now they've got an anti-satellite weapon that is stationed in orbit that they're demonstrating they can use.
Obviously, when you talk about ground-based systems, there are kinetic missiles. So the U.S. approach is to put it on an F-15, fly it high and launching it. Chinese launched directly from the ground. But of course, there have been lasers as well to dazzle spacecraft as well as signals jamming and the like. And this issue of spacecraft in orbits that intersect or get very close to our spacecraft has always been an issue about space mines or, right, that some of these things on intersecting or close flyby orbits may not be benign, right? I mean, I reported on right. that about 15 years ago, if I recall, that the issue was, you know, whether somebody as it flies by, for example, would choose to detonate sort of a space mine. You've studied the whole panoply of the weaponization of space. Everybody is very, very concerned that when folks do this, the Chinese anti-satellite weapons test, for example, left so much debris in orbit that it continues to be a problem to this very day. Talk to us a little bit about nations. What are the capabilities that are up there? What's unsettling? And in particular, the attitudes that different nations have toward these systems, right, which are remarkably blasé, I think is probably one way of putting it from an American standpoint.
Yeah, so the whole debate about this is interesting. And, you know, this was the subject of a paper that I published through CSIS last month, looking at international perspectives on the weaponization of space. What I find interesting is that countries like Russia and China keep pushing this narrative that they don't want space to be weaponized. And Russia has come out and taken a pledge with other countries like Venezuela that they will not be the first to weaponize space. But when you look at what they really mean by that, really it's hypocritical. They're talking about, you know, what they propose. Russia and China have jointly proposed banning space-based anti-satellite capabilities. So objects in space that can harm other satellites in space, as well as they want to ban space-based weapons that can attack locations on Earth. What they do not want to ban are the ground-based anti-satellite weapons, whether kinetic or non-kinetic in the means of their effect. So their diplomatic statements would seem to indicate the way they define weaponization is it has to be something that is based in orbit. But it's intriguing that they say that they won't be the first to weaponize space when here they are using space-based anti-satellite capabilities, demonstrating them in a test. And the Soviet Union in the Cold War conducted about 20 tests of space-based kinetic anti-satellite weapons. So yeah, they're not going to be the first to weaponize space because they already weaponized it by their own definition.
I think that's very funny. I also think it's very funny that the Russian naming nomenclature is very Soviet with Cosmos series satellites. Let me just go back to the test for a second. So how would this Russian system operate, right? So the spacecraft that was doing the snooping then ejected a spacecraft. What does that ejected spacecraft do? I mean, is that something kinetic? Does it fly closer to another spacecraft and detonate? Does it accidentally bump into it to be able to give it plausible deniability? Well, I don't know. I mean, something broke off my satellite. I mean, I couldn't help that the solar panel hit yours. I mean, right? How would they use this spacecraft, right?
So from the public statement, and I should just pause and just say that it is progress that the U.S. military and the U.S. government actually put out a statement calling Russia out on this. Stuff like this has happened in the past. They've, you know, often not said anything, not acknowledged it, and it's been amateur space track folks that find this. But here, you know, space...
The Javril Bank crowd, right, was looking and being like, wait a minute. You know, we've heard a signal of something. I mean that respectfully. I don't mean that at all pejoratively, by the way.
Yeah, no, but it is progress that, you know, U.S. Space Command is now being more proactive and calling out Russia and China on these types of activities. But if you look at the statement carefully, it doesn't really say what the capabilities of the object are. So if that's something that the government knows, they're not revealing it, which makes sense. You don't want to necessarily give away, you know, your ways and means and how you're, you know, able to characterize these objects. But I'll tell you, what's the range of possibilities of what it could be? So it could be a kinetic kill vehicle that's designed to just maneuver close to a satellite, detonate a small charge, and take it out, or just maneuver into and collide with the satellite in order to harm it. You know, when you do that, you know, you're going to produce a lot of debris. This object is in low Earth orbit. So some of that debris would decay over time into the atmosphere, but not all of it. You could end up making quite a mess for other satellites. That's why I think it may be more likely that the means of attack is non-kinetic. So this smaller satellite that's ejected, it could be doing other things, like if it's going up against an imagery satellite, maybe it could release some sort of obscurant that would damage the lens, the optics, the mirror that's in the satellite. It could have a high power microwave weapon inside it that just does a small high power microwave burst in very close proximity to the satellite in order to basically fry its circuits. It could have an in-space jammer where it just jams communication links that are going from a target satellite to other places on Earth or other satellites in space. So it could just be designed to be an in-space jammer. So there's a lot of things that Russia could be doing with the satellite and testing. All we really know is that this test was non-destructive. There are not pieces of debris that have been produced from it.
Right. But it doesn't mean at all that the capability isn't something that's at the end of the day worrisome. How does the United States need to respond to this, Todd? Because the limit, you know, you're only limited by your imagination. X-37 has conducted a whole series of among the most classified missions that the United States has ever executed. very, very lengthy missions that both have a situational awareness component, but as well as important research and other operations. How does the United States need to be responding to this sort of extant and escalating threat?
Yeah, I mean, the first step is always admitting you have a problem, right? and at least, you know, we're starting to do that now. And so there, you know, Space Command is coming out in this statement. They're saying that, hey, this is a problem, and they are publicly calling out Russia for its activities in space. I think, you know, the next step, of course, is bilateral discussions between the countries. And it looks like that's taking place now as well. I think they've got talks set up in Vienna. And, you know, a step beyond that is, you know, the government needs to be more transparent and more forthcoming with evidence, where it can be declassified without giving away sources and methods. That's great. Release it publicly. If it can't always be declassified, then we at least need to find ways of reading in our close allies and partners so that they have the same understanding of what Russia is doing in space as we do. So that, you know, they understand the developments, the capabilities, and the actions that we're seeing. But, you know, beyond that, I think that this just goes to show that this is, you know, a modern domain of warfare, and we've got to get past this hand-wringing about, oh, should we weaponize space? Should we not? It's already weaponized, right? And the question now is, how do we deal with that? And, you know, in particular, how do we deter hostile actions in space? Because we all understand, everyone in the space community and beyond understands that you do not want kinetic attacks going off in space. That's not in anyone's interest, certainly not in our interest, as dependent as we are on space. So we've got to look at, okay, how do we deter these kinds of capabilities from being used? They are developed, you know, other countries have them. They're only going to get better at this in the future. So, you know, we've just got to refocus our efforts on deterrence, and that, you know, there's two sides of deterrence here. There's, you know, raising the cost, making it more costly if they use weapons like this in the future, and the ways that we could retaliate, the ways that we can make it more difficult for their weapons to be effective. But, you know, we've also got to reduce the benefits and give ourselves alternative systems so that we're not as vulnerable to attacks on just a small handful of our critical space assets.
But let me, right, I mean, to those who bemoan the militarization of space, space from its inception was a military theater. The first thing to go up there was a V-2 rocket, right? So at the end of the day, the Salyut space station was an Earth observation, right? And if you thought that it was just to figure out, you know, climate change on the Siberian taiga, that's not exactly what that spacecraft was for. It had a very powerful telescope, and it had a reconnaissance capability to it, which the Soviets lacked compared to what our capabilities were, right? I mean, so this has been a theater that's been a military theater since its inception. Ask anybody in the Apollo program, that was a battle. That was a Cold War battle of the first order. It was just played, in the field of science, but with military people, largely. Let me ask you, from a deterrent standpoint, a leading American spacecraft is a multi-billion dollar asset and extension of the United States. It is sovereign property. It is government property. Why not treat that as if it's a spaceborne base, and that any attack on the sovereign capability of the United States will be causus belli? I mean, don't we need to get into that kind of thing, that this is not any gray area that, oops, you know, my satellite bumped into yours, how could I know? My anchor fell and cut your undersea cable. Oh gosh, how did that happen? Right? I think, back to the calling you out on it, will that be the sort of thing that's needed to try to avoid getting into the whole tit for tat or, playing the plausible deniability game, which really sounds totally Cold War Soviet, right? Like completely implausible. Moscow has something implausible to say, which Beijing increasingly does as well.
Yeah, no, I think you're raising a lot of the questions that policymakers are grappling with right now. You know, first of all, you've got to have good and timely attribution of attacks, whether they're kinetic or non-kinetic forms of attack. The non-kinetic are, you know, can be more difficult to attribute, you know, so that you actually have good information for, you know, your senior decision makers on whether or not you have been attacked and what the effects have been and where it came from. You also need a greater degree of public awareness so that it's, you know, other people realize what's happening. And then that gives you a lot more freedom in how you can respond to an attack in space. But, you know, it still boils down to an issue that's not all that dissimilar to an issue we're facing in other domains of warfare, particularly with unmanned systems and cyber forms of attack, is what's a proportionate response to an attack against a system where there's no loss of human life? You know, if someone blows up a $1 billion satellite of ours, no one died directly as a right. result of that. It harms our national security because it's taken away right. this capability, which could down the road lead to loss of life on the ground, but very indirectly, you can't trace it back to that. I would say it's, you know, it's a similar situation as we faced when the Iranians shot down one of our Global Hawk aircraft, you know, out in the Persian Gulf. How do you respond to that? And, you know, that was an interesting, you know, case. And we saw the insight into the senior decision maker's thinking because he put it on Twitter, where President Trump said, you know, they were all geared up to launch a strike against, I think, some of the air defense systems that were used in that attack. And he called it off because, you know, they briefed him that there was a likelihood that, you know, there were going to be some Iranian personnel and there would be loss of life with those strikes. And he didn't think that that was right. proportionate use of force. Since they shut down our Global Hawk, no one died. It's going to be a similar type of calculation in space, except the stakes are a bit higher because you've got the potential for orbital debris that will linger for a long time and have indiscriminate effects in space. And the systems are much, in many cases, they're much more expensive and much more difficult to replace. And so that's something that we've got to be prepared to deal with. And it's not just a question we have to answer for ourselves. We have to, you know, make those decisions in consultation with our allies and partners, because in whatever situation on the ground that results in conflict in space, we are likely to be in that with other countries, with our partners and allies, and we need to all have a shared understanding of what the right response or set of potential responses would be.
Is there a consensus developing between the United States and its allies on the best way to do that?
I think 10 years ago, there was not. I think that there's been a lot of progress since then, and mainly it's because a lot of our closest allies have been seeing the same behaviors in space that we've been observing. You know, in particular, you know, I look to countries like France, Britain, Japan, where, you know, they are taking the threat to space systems much more seriously now. And so I think that we are starting to develop more of a consensus about what constitutes a hostile act in space, what constitutes an act of war, what are the range of responses that would be justified by different types of attack. It's always going to be very situationally dependent. It is always going to depend on what's happening on the ground. But I think that we are starting to develop more cohesion with allies and partners about how we think about space issues.
How does the proliferation of satellites in space change the game? You know, anybody who's even an amateur astronomer now is sort of stunned at the sheer number of Starlink satellites. Elon Musk's plan is to put more than 1,000 of those spacecraft in orbit. They're in large string constellations. you know, at the end of the day, what is the opportunity for much more distributed satellite systems? I mean, basically, do the kind of efforts that the Chinese and the Russians are putting in there drive the end of those rather large military satellites, and you replace them with a whole bunch of smaller satellites, including clever payloads on commercial spacecraft in a shell game that makes it a lot harder to target a specific capability? And if you lose it, you only lose 3% of your capacity instead of losing 30% of your capacity.
I mean, you know, more distributed architectures of small satellites. So large numbers of smaller satellites that in aggregate can have similar capabilities as larger, more expensive satellites. That seems to be the trend in the commercial space industry. We are also seeing movement in that direction by the U.S. military as well, and in particular, what the Space Development Agency is proposing to build and launch over the next few years. But I would point out that we have another parallel effort to basically modernize and recapitalize all of our legacy space systems, many of which are fielded in very small numbers. They're very highly aggregated capabilities on these satellites. They're very expensive, take a long time to build and launch. We're in the process of replacing many of those constellations right now, and in parallel, starting to move forward on these more disaggregated, dispersed designs for satellites. So I think it is a transition that's happening, but it's not going to be 100% transition for the U.S. military over to more dispersed constellations. It will be gradual, but it puts us in a good place to actually have both, to have the large, exquisite capabilities, but then also have the smaller, dispersed capabilities. That adds more diversity, more complexity for adversaries to try to target these systems. It makes them inherently more resilient because we have some backups, and capabilities. So I think that's where we're going. The question is, are we going to get there soon enough? Are we going to transition our space architectures over to be more resilient, more dispersed, fast enough, to get ahead of the threats that we're seeing developed?
At the end of the day, going back to your earlier point about the response to the RQ-4, there are times when you have to kill the ant with a sledgehammer. And when it's $200 million or $250 million in U.S. government property, and if that government property was doing reconnaissance over international waters, you have to respond, even if it may cause the loss of life for an adversary. Otherwise, it encourages other people to misbehave.
It's telling that, that incident happened in the Gulf and, there was a limited response. It certainly was not a kinetic response. And that set a precedent. And I think that did communicate something to other countries about, our escalation thresholds when it comes to unmanned systems. And, we've got to be careful about setting those precedents in other domains and in particular in space. If there's a non-kinetic attack that, permanently disables or destroys one of our satellites in orbit, we don't want to let that go unanswered, right?
Exactly.
And the response, may very well not be in space, and that's fine. You can respond in other domains, but it does, require a response just so you set the precedent that that's not acceptable. And there will be consequences. Otherwise, you're just inviting more conflict in space.
Right. And then what happens when somebody decides, well, they didn't respond for a $200 million reconnaissance plane. I just took out a $2 billion satellite with some deniability, right? Contrived deniability, right? I mean, yeah. I think that anybody, it's enough to sow doubt. That's very, very problematic at that point because the whole notion that you will kinetically respond on Earth is regarded as problematic, right? There are those who've always said, like, hey, if you're going to hold my satellites at risk from your base you know, on Earth, I'm going to destroy your base to stop you from doing that. Well, people might say, well, wait a minute, hold on a second. That's kind of an escalation. So that's the reason why you've got to sort of set the deterrent structure of what's acceptable and not. And simply because something is unmanned does not automatically mean that there is no response to it, right? Because then you carry that over into the space domain. Or cyber, for that matter, right?
Yeah, and then this is setting precedent in the cyber domain as well, where, you know, attacks are, you know, system against system, and, you know, you're not going to be killing people directly. And so this is an area where, you know, this is where warfare is going in the future, and we've got to be very careful at how we respond now to set precedents that we will, you know, be happy to live with in the future.
Let me take you to the question of the Space Force. You were an advocate, a strong advocate of it. It's now been born. It now has a logo. It's got a motto. The logo is a little Starfleet reminiscent, but still pretty classy. Keeping it classy there, General Raymond. And then Always Above, which is a great Semper Supra, right, is the motto of the force. We've gone through the National Defense Authorization Act. The House and Senate have passed it with veto-proof majorities, despite the president's inclination to veto it. We don't know any more about that at the time that we're taping this. But talk to us about, in legislation, are lawmakers doing the things they have to do to make sure that the Space Force succeeds, including the organizational issues, the issue of the NRO having to be subsumed in there, and other organizations, in order to make it as successful as it needs to be?
I would say yes and no. And, you know, I'll reserve judgment until we see a final bill come out of conference committee. But, you know, I'll tell you that there are a handful of things that need to happen pretty quickly to get this on the right track. One is, you know, giving the Space Force explicitly in law a 4-star deputy chief of space operations. You know, they need that 4-star position so that the deputy will be on par with the other deputies of the other services. So that's important. And yes, DOD could do that on their own, but I think it's important to go ahead and set it in the law. You know, also there's this issue of the service acquisition executive for space within the Department of the Air Force. So right now, the current law says that there'll be a separate assistant secretary for space for acquisitions, but that, you know, doesn't transfer over. The authority doesn't transfer over until 2022. And so, you know, the Air Force has basically said, yeah, we're not going to do it any sooner than that. So that's something that Congress is looking at as well, is maybe we need to accelerate that and do that sooner rather than later. And I think that's going to be important as well, because really, you know, a lot of the issues folks have had with space over the past, you know, 20, 30 years, the way the military has kind of lagged behind in space, it's been because of problems in the acquisition system. So, you know, I think getting this split of the Service Acquisition Authority is a good first step. It doesn't solve the problems, but it can get you, it'll certainly get the senior civilian leadership more focused intently on unique space acquisition issues. And so I think the sooner they can make that split, the better, quite frankly, to get space programs, you know, off on a new track. You know, and then like you raised the issue of the intel side of space, and specifically the NRO, that's not included in the Space Force right now. That was deliberate, that, you know, Congress was taking this one step at a time. So was the Trump administration. I think in the long run, I agree with your premise that for this to really work out, we need a Space Force that includes all of our military and intel space capabilities, all, you know, together under one unified chain of command and leadership, because there is so much that happens where you need good coordination in acquisition programs and technology development and in day-to-day operations. You need that, you know, seamless cooperation between the military and the intel side of space. I think that there are, you know, logical ways of doing it where you don't disrupt the goodness that's in the NRO, where you slide it over as, you know, entire organization. You don't try to break it up or anything, certainly not at first. But putting that all under one unified chain of command, I think in the long run, that makes sense. I think that's where the Trump administration would go if they have a second bite at this in terms of space reorganization. But it doesn't look like Congress is really there yet.
I will believe it when I see it. At the end of the day, if you're going to create a space force, it can't just be something that weakens the Air Force. Everybody's space assets have to go into there. And I can already sense that each of the services is making a case why they won't part with their people, saying that, well, we need our own internal capabilities. So we're actually not going to give up people for those endeavors, right? And so that's kind of problematic at the end of the day. And the argument they use is, well, I mean, people join the Army to be in the Army. People join the Navy to be in the Navy.
Well, this is where it's going to require some strong leadership from the top, from the Secretary of Defense, to make sure that the things that need to transition over from the other services into the Space Force, that they do, that they correctly identify them, that they identify the billets, if not the specific people, and make sure that that stuff gets transitioned over. The last thing we want to do is repeat the mistakes of when we created the Air Force. And, you know, left a lot of, you know, land-based fixed wing aircraft capabilities in the other services. And, you know, I don't think that's worked to our advantage, in terms of, you know, being more coordinated in what we're doing in the air domain. So we ought to learn from that and make sure that doesn't happen this time around.
They should have delayed it and gotten all these details right instead of getting out the door crooked. And then ending up with a liability on that. We can talk more about that later. We got 30 seconds left. Talk to us a little bit about your event tomorrow and what you hope the key takeaways from it are going to be, or what you hope it's going to accomplish.
Yeah, we're actually hosting folks from DIU and the Space Force and other parts of the government for a release of a report that they've published. It's the annual update to their assessment of the space industrial base. So we're going to have folks from the government side presenting the key findings and recommendations of that report. That report gets released at the time of our event starts tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern time. And then we're going to have another panel after that of industry and other outside experts to react to the report and the comment on its findings and share their own perspectives of what's going on in the space industrial base. And I think it's very timely given all that's going on with the pandemic and all the uncertainty that we're seeing around industry, and especially a lot that's going on in the commercial space industry right now. So I think it's going to be a very exciting and insightful event.
What time?
11 a.m. Eastern tomorrow, Tuesday morning.
And they should go to the CSIS website, where I think they'll be able to see it there, correct?
Yeah, it's a Zoom webinar. So if you go to our website, aerospace.csis.org, you'll see the event. Click on that, and you've got to register an event in advance and then join the Zoom webinar live. We'll be taking live question and answer from the audience.
What is the state of the space industrial base? What preview can you give people? Is it good? Bad?
I mean, mixed? I think there's good and bad. I think that
it's very decisive, Todd.
Well, for commercial companies, I think that this pandemic and the economic crisis came at a really bad time, because you had a lot of commercially oriented space companies that had already committed a lot of capital and were just starting to roll out new constellations and new services. And then the economic crisis hits. Capital markets are drying up, and it's going to be hard for a lot of these companies to actually turn the corner and start making money. And so I think it's a perilous time. On the military and government side of space, I think things are as good as ever, and they're looking bright in the future as long as Russia keeps, and Russia and China keep up all the threats in space. There's going to be plenty for our defense side of the space industrial base to be working on.
Todd, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. It's always a treat having you on. Break a leg at the event. I'll definitely be tuning in, and I hope others do as well. Thanks very much for all the great work. Thank you.
Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.